You're traveling through another podcast. A podcast not only of reviewing and discussing, but of discovery. A journey into a wondrous show whose boundaries are that of imagination. That's the RSS feed up ahead. Your next stop, Anthology. Hello, and welcome to Season 2 of Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. Anthology is one man's examination of The Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer. Each episode, I review one episode of Rod Serling's iconic series and round out the show with a bonus review of a movie or show related to the week's main topic. I also cover modern anthology science fiction shows such as Black Mirror and Dimension 404 in bonus episode review series that I have separate from the main podcast episodes. You can find more of Anthology as well as a full episode archive at anthologypod.com. And if you want to contact me, you can use the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod, tweet me at obsessiveviewer, or send me an email to matt@obsessiveviewer.com. And just on that note, thank you everyone for sending me messages and emails and Facebook messages and tweets in the interim between seasons 1 and 2. It took a little bit longer of a hiatus than I expected to. Just got kind of bogged down with work and everything. But I'm back, and I'm excited to get started on Season 2. And I'm also excited to do bonus episodes for Dimension 404, which is currently on Hulu. Spoiler for that, I enjoyed the first episode. I thought it was fun. So look for my more thorough thoughts on that in the latest bonus episode series of Anthology. So today on the podcast, I'll be discussing King Nine Will Not Return. It's the first episode of The Twilight Zone's second season, and it aired on September 30th, 1960. And for this week's bonus review, I'll share my thoughts on Bomber's Moon, which is a 1958 episode of Playhouse 90, starring King Nine Will Not Return's Bob Cummings, and co-starring Martin Balsam and Rip Torn. As always, I will be spoiling the episode of The Twilight Zone that I'm reviewing in this podcast, so if you haven't watched King Nine Will Not Return, I highly suggest going and checking it out on Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, or DVD, Blu-ray, whatever medium you have for it. It's available. It's pretty well available. So for Season 1, I was really going through The Twilight Zone Companion by Mark Sicri for a resource and everything. I'm still using that and everything, but for I recently bought The Twilight Zone Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic by Martin Grahams Jr., who actually on the DVD does a commentary for this episode. And first of all, this freaking book, it's massive. Like, it is incredibly detailed. He has each episode broken down by the dates that they were rehearsed, the dates the scripts, each revision of each script was turned in, the budget for the secretary and the unit manager and the agent's commission on it, and overall production costs for each episode individually, and legal and accounting fees, stuff like that. It's a really interesting book. And so what I'm going to be doing is kind of to change things up. I'm going to read the plot description of King Nine Will Not Return through courtesy of The Twilight Zone Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic. So once again, we're going to be spoiling the episode, so if you haven't watched it, go ahead and pause this and come back when you have. And I'm going to go ahead and read the plot description now. Captain James Embry wakes to find himself alone in the desert, surrounded by the bellied wreckage of the King Nine. Sifting through torn wires, smashed metal, and shattered glass, he is unable to find any evidence that his crew is within sight or sound. He seeks rescue with the help of a radio that provides no answer. Suffering from both heat and hallucinations, Embry envisions the ghosts of his crew and wonders if his mind has snapped. He finds a grave marker for one of the crew members. He witnesses jet aircraft flying overhead, apparently out of place and out of time. Finally, he screams from exhaustion and wakes in a hospital bed with a doctor and psychiatrist looking over him. Apparently, a recent article in the local newspaper about a World War II bomber found intact in the desert caused Embry's mind to snap. He has accepted the blame for a crash during the war that caused the death of his crew, which still plagues him. Embry laughs, wondering if maybe he should have been on board the plane that day when it went down and disappeared. But the psychiatrist claims a guilty conscience is to blame. Yet, as the doctor and psychiatrist exit the room, they observe sand falling out of Embry's shoe. And in case you were wondering, the total production cost for this episode was $61,812.53. I won't do that for every episode, but I think that that's kind of an interesting resource and interesting resource for me doing this podcast. But anyway, this episode stars Robert Cummings as Captain James Embry. This was his only Twilight Zone episode. And he was also in Playhouse 90's Bomber's Moon, which I'm going to review later in this episode, and then also in Hitchcock's Dial M for Murder. He and Serling had more, they wanted to do more work together. He was originally pitched as the lead in The Loner when Serling pitched it around to different places before it finally got picked up. He was the original star of it before it was finally picked up with the Lloyd Bridges as the star. Robert Cummings studied briefly in Drury College in Springfield, Missouri, but his love of flying caused him to transfer to the Carnegie Institute of Technology in Pittsburgh, where he studied aeronautical engineering for a year before he had to drop out due to financial reasons. Since his family had lost heavily in the 1929 stock market crash. He was known as an avid flyer, though. Writer for this episode is Rod Serling. The episode is based on the discovery of the Lady Be Good, which was a B-24 Liberator bomber. It and her crew's remains were found deep in the Libyan desert after... It was back in 1958. That's when it was found. And... The Lady Be Good went down. It had crash landed at night deep in the Libyan desert after running out of fuel while returning from a World War II bombing mission over Naples, Italy. The actual date that it was lost was April 5th, 1943, which is also the date that is on the marker of the grave in King Nine Will Not Return. Also kind of interesting is that it was found the remains of the aircraft were found in 1958, and the bodies of eight of the nine-man crew were found between February and August of 1960. And the eighth of that was found just a few weeks before King Nine Will Not Return aired. And director for this episode is Buzz Kulik. This is his first of nine Twilight Zone episodes. Next we'll see from him is The Trouble with Templeton, which I'll be reviewing in a few weeks here. He also directed The Yellow Canary, which was my bonus review of Anthology Episode 24, the episode where I reviewed Nightmare as a Child from Season 1 of Twilight Zone. He also directed a TV movie called A Storm in Summer, which was written by Rod Serling and won two Emmys, one for Outstanding Lead Actor and one for Outstanding Drama Production. A Storm in Summer is about a friendship between an elderly Jewish man and a young African-American boy set during the Vietnam War. Out of curiosity, since it is a Serling and Kulik production, I did look for it. I couldn't really find it anywhere. So maybe hopefully by the time I get to The Trouble with Templeton or one of Buzz Kulik's other nine or other eight, or I guess at that point seven Twilight Zone episodes, I'll be able to find that, because that would be an interesting, the premise sounds like it would be an interesting bonus review for Anthology. So going into King Nine Will Not Return, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know much about it. The title of it made me think that it was maybe something to do with chess. King Nine feels like a chess term, like knights to kings, rooks to seven or whatever. I don't really know chess that well. But from what I gathered before watching this episode and in the interim between, like, by just doing this podcast and everything, I've learned that the episode had something to do with fighter pilots. And then for some reason, I also thought that it might have had something to do with aliens as well, but I wasn't sure. I may be mistaking that for another episode. Yeah, so going into this, that's what I those were the expectations I went into King Nine Will Not Return. As for the actual episode, I liked it a lot. I thought it was a very strong season two, or a very strong season opener, and it's a nice reflection of the series premiere of Where Is Everybody, which I'll talk about in more detail a little bit later. But the first thing I notice is there's that iconic Twilight Zone music in the opening theme, and that coupled with Rod Serling's first on-screen like narration, that, I don't know, I felt so giddy and so excited, because as much as I loved season one, and I really did love season one, and as much as I really loved going through it and reviewing it and everything, I'm still really, I'm very much aware that I've merely dented this series. Like, I'm still super new to the Twilight Zone. I still have a lot to go through and to go into with this project here at Anthology. And things like hearing that iconic music at the start of the episode and seeing Serling on screen introducing the episode, I know that those are things that are going to endure, that are going to endure throughout the rest of the show's run. And it's so exciting to me. Like, I feel like I've reached another level to the Twilight Zone and to my new reasonably newfound fandom or late coming to enjoying the Twilight Zone, which, I mean, after season one, I still think, I mean, this is, the podcast itself is more, it's less me going through the Twilight Zone as a first time viewer, and it's more me kind of discovering one of my favorite TV shows of all time. And I say that after only seeing the first season, which is a strong statement. So, yeah, so let's see. So as far as the opening narration, it's classic, classic Serling. The dialogue or the actual words that he uses is just very, poetic and beautiful. It's got that Serling flourish that I'm just so enamored with. So we learn that King Nine is a bomber that left Tunisia to bomb, Italy and crashed in the desert. And just from the set design, just from the perspective of the set design and everything, it's just really captivating to see just this pure desolation, just this completely empty desert, just populated with a downed aircraft. It's really staggering the scope of it with such minimal detail. And I say minimal detail, even though it clearly cost a ton, and was very likely a very extravagant process to get the actual plane into the desert and everything. But that's like the only piece of setting in the episode, and it really works to really amplify the point of the tone of the episode. And as an aside, I didn't really research this too closely, but I kind of wondered if the markings on the side of the bomber, there's, I think, three swastikas and a whole bunch of bombs on it. I kind of wonder if the swastikas are supposed to be the amount of, or the like a tally of the German planes that the King Nine had shot down. And I wonder if the bombs were, how many bombs had been dropped out of the King Nine throughout its run. That's what I assumed. If someone has a better explanation or a better idea of what it was, let me know, because I'm kind of intrigued by it. And the next thing that I thought was pretty interesting with the episode was that we get an inner monologue for Embry. And I thought that was interesting because, as I said, this episode kind of has a lot of similarities to Where Is Everybody? It's one person in a setting that's completely empty with some weird Twilight Zone things going on. And what worked with Where Is Everybody, something that I liked about it was how Earl Holliman's character, how he was speaking his feelings, how he was speaking out loud about what was going on and his fears and everything. On the flip side here, when we have Embry having his inner monologue there, it brings it to a more sinister kind of sense, the story, I mean. It brings it to a more inner struggle, which is what this episode needs. I think that both ways work for each individual episode. So, like, Where Is Everybody? It worked that he was speaking out loud to nothing, because that kind of let us really get behind him as a character and really root for him, essentially. Whereas with this, we see that something sinister is going on, or we see that we're learning that there's something really amiss with everything. And his inner monologue is both guiding us to it while also kind of preparing us for the truth of what it is, because there's a lot of mystery surrounding it. And it would have felt a little weird to have him speaking it out loud throughout the entire episode. Having an inner monologue voiceover is more appropriate for this, because it is a reflection of his cracked psyche and how he will, he's guiding us while also guiding himself is the best way I would describe that. So I appreciate that, and I liked it. When that started, I thought it would be pretty cool if that was just how the entire episode was. Like, if he didn't have any dialogue, he just, it was all inner monologue. Which I'm glad that that's not what they did. Because the energy and nuance that Bob Cummings gave to the performance there, with all of his, like, dialogue, was really, really, pretty impressive in the episode. And it would have been, if it was just all inner monologue, it would have been it would have hampered him, hampered his performance. It would have downplayed, it wouldn't have given him a lot to work with. And while it did remind me of Where Is Everybody, it kind of also reminded me of A Shot an Arrow into the Air. And while it did remind me of both of those, like, setting for A Shot an Arrow into the Air and kind of the general plot and the desolation of Where Is Everybody, it still felt fresh to me. It still felt like a fresh Twilight Zone episode. I don't mean to say that, oh, it feels like an amalgamation of these two episodes of the Twilight Zone. I just mean that it just kind of reminds me of them. And I think that's kind of a good look at the work of Serling and the work of the show, is that even though this episode can remind me of two outstanding episodes from the first season, it still feels new and fresh, which makes me wonder also, I have no idea if this was intentional or if this was something meta that Serling included into the script strictly because of feedback received from the first season. But when Bob Cummings, when he is doing his whole inner monologue where he's pitching, like, ideas, or not pitching ideas, but he's saying that he's trying to stay rational and calm. He is trying to say that he is that what's going on isn't really happening. He's just lost his marbles. He's somewhere else. He's not here. This isn't real. When he has all of these ideas and everything, it made me wonder, and I really wonder this, and I couldn't find anywhere if this was the intention or not, but I kind of wonder if Serling put that into the episode as a way to both wink at the audience of the Twilight Zone, because the first season had numerous times where the ending just completely shattered the audience's preconceived notions of what was going on throughout the episode. And I wonder if he did that intentionally to kind of wink at them and show them that, like, hey, yeah, I know, we're both in this game and we both know how it goes. or if he did it to further make the audience guess even more. Because, you know, if you're sitting there thinking like, okay, well, maybe he's dead, he's a ghost. Oh wait, if he just said that, actually I don't even think he really said that, but just for sake of argument, if you say one theory and then the actor says that same theory, you're not gonna like, you're it's just gonna make you wonder what the hell is going on. Like, he sees jets, like, perfect example, he sees jets and he says, like, your immediate thought is, whoa, did he time travel? Is there some time travel thing there? And then he's just like, jets, I shouldn't know what jets are. And I'm getting ahead of myself in the review, but I loved that aspect of it. And I think that if it was intentional or not, or if it's what Serling wanted to do, or if it's what Serling was going for, I mean, it worked perfectly for me, because it just felt like such a writer playing with the audience kind of thing. And it was also a really great way for him to stay one step ahead of the audience, because I was trying to guess what was going on too, and I couldn't really come up with anything, or I kept getting hit with that dialogue and just second guessing everything that I thought. So it worked well. So when Bob Cummings or James Embry, when he is in the plane and he's kind of looking through it, the radio receiver, the radio turns on right next to him. And I had an interesting experience with this, and I think it reflects really the first viewing aspect of this podcast, is that when he's walking through the aircraft, and then once that, like, that radio suddenly turns on and there's that static, like, it kind of freaked me out a little bit. Like, I thought it was frightening. In the first viewing I had of it, I've seen the episode a few times now, my first viewing, I thought you can almost hear a voice when it turns on. Like, you can almost hear like a scrambled voice and not just static. But what was interesting is that when I went back and rewatched it a second and third and fourth time, I tried to hear that again, but I couldn't really hear it. I rewound it and everything, and I still couldn't hear that voice that I heard the first time. And I think that is really indicative of how strong the episode is written, how strongly the episode's written, because when I first watched it, I was so absorbed with the setting and the scenario that was playing out in front of me, that when you have this sudden burst of static sound playing in a scene, like, my brain, like, extrapolated that into something even more sinister and frightening, because I was so primed for it, because this is such a unsettling and an unnerving story that's being played out in front of me. And what's interesting is after that section, or after he can't get anyone on the radio, he starts calming himself. He tries to calm himself, and he's trying to stay rational and he's trying to stay calm, but you can tell he's terrified and he's freaked out of what's going on. And it kind of comes across like he's lying to himself. He's saying that he's responsible for the crew. He's trying to view it like, this is back when it was before he said I'm responsible for this crew, but he said that he was sure that he was dreaming or this isn't real, that stuff. It comes across like he's just telling himself that to feel better and to get a better handle on the situation. He's not really believing what he's saying, but he's saying it to try to make himself believe it. And then when he says that he's responsible for this crew, I liked the double meaning behind that, because he's both responsible for the people, like, he's saying he's responsible for the crew because he is responsible for their lives, and he, like, that's his purpose, is that he needs to find them and rescue them and make sure they're okay. While also the subtext of that, or his subconscious, is that he's responsible for what's happened to this crew, that they're gone because he couldn't save them or didn't save them. And it's at that point that I realized that this episode reminded me a lot of Flight of the Phoenix, which was a novel that was based on Flight of the Phoenix was a novel that was inspired by the Lady Be Good story, and became a couple movies first movie? I don't remember. I don't know what year the original movie came out, but it had Jimmy Stewart in it, I think. And then it was remade in, I think, 2004. Giovanni Ribisi was in it. And I think Dennis Quaid. Dennis Quaid and Giovanni Ribisi. I remember seeing the one from the early 2000s and thinking it was okay. So he finds a canteen in the sand, and he notices that it's Klein's, one of his crew members' canteen. And what I liked about this discovery in this scene is that it's the start of his psychological breakdown, sort of. Not necessarily the start, but it's the escalation of it, because he finds it, and it's like this little glimmer of hope, because it's confirmation that, you know, maybe they're around, or it's gives him a little bit of hope. And what I loved is the way that he's yelling insults at him. He's excited because he feels like this is a clue that, you know, they're okay, or that they're nearby. And he starts yelling. I think he says, like, you damned idiot, or you stupid idiot, you left your canteen. And he's laughing about it. And on one hand, this really speaks to the kind of power of Serling's writing, that on one hand, it's like he's excited, he's happy because he has this clue, or he has this indication that they're around. But also it's this kind of freaked out kind of thing, because it's still like, you know, that it appeared there, it's not supposed to be there, you know, that they're nowhere around, that it could be something more sinister going on. And then the third layer of it is that it shows the camaraderie of him with his crew, and how close he is with the crew members, that he is speaking like a buddy, like that. And it's really incredible the way that Serling can make a character, what I loved about that was that Serling created character development among a group of people, essentially, with only having one person on camera. Like, he created this dynamic between Embry and the rest of his crew without even needing the crew in the scene. And I think that that's just really incredible storytelling. And at this point, I kind of felt like the canteen was placed there for a purpose, like he was supposed to find it. I thought that maybe it would basically, or maybe it would come into play later, like maybe someone left it there and poisoned him, because after he drinks from it, that's when he sees Blake in the cockpit. And I think it's the cockpit, or maybe the gunner seat. I'm pretty sure it's the cockpit, though. But that scene, like that was such a creepy, creepy moment, because he doesn't just see Blake in the seat there. It's this really weird, unsettling way about him. The actor that's doing it, he's moving in a very unnatural way. It's like he's laughing, but it's like seeing a picture laugh at you while being moved back and forth. Like his face is frozen in an open smile, and he's rocking back and forth, but it's like his entire body is moving at once. And it's kind of like he's moving like a rag doll, and it's this happy but really dead expression on his face. And it's very brief. It's only on screen for like a few seconds, but man, it really, like that really got under my skin in a really good way. It was really unsettling to me. And then Embry goes back to talking about how he's responsible for the crew. And that's when you get the indication that, you know, guilt is overriding his, that guilt is consuming him. And it felt like guilt was overriding his actual survival instincts. Like, I was thinking, like, you know, he should be, you know, trying to find rescue, or trying to find a way to get back and or to get to safety, but he's just overcome with guilt. And it kind of seemed like the between the guilt of losing his crew, like the thought of losing his crew and the guilt behind losing his crew with his survival instincts, it kind of felt like they were battling it out internally within him for what should take precedence. That's the indication that I got, or that's something that I thought was kind of a little bit hinted at there, because he wasn't really searching for, he was just searching for the crew, and he was losing his sanity in that way. And then he even kind of expounds that by saying that, like, he starts thinking that maybe everything is a hallucination. And that's kind of the next stage of him rationalizing what he can't make sense of. And also that's another clever and kind of cheeky way for, at least I assume, I don't know if this was intentional, but it felt like they were playing into the audience's expectations from the Twilight Zone and what the audience is going into season two of a show that had surprised them in the first season, kind of playing on what their expectations of the show was to be. And to talk a little bit about Bob Cummings' performance, I mean, I loved it. I really loved his performance. I would say that I think that maybe I like Earl Holloman's performance in Where Is Everybody a little bit better. But I really like the energy that Bob Cummings brought to the performance. And he has this nuance to it that he's overcome with this guilt and this fear, but he's still rationalizing everything. He's still trying to find his answers. And it's, in that regard, I think that his character has a lot more drama to draw from than Earl Holloman did in Where Is Everybody? And they're completely different stories, obviously, with some pretty interesting similarities. But I think given how much dramatic potential there was with Bob Cummings's role, I think he really nailed it, and he really explored that character in a way that I really found satisfying. I just think that I connected to Earl Holloman's performance a little bit more in that regard. And then the next part, we get a couple really quick things that are pretty huge for the episode. So Embry finds a grave marking that's for Klein. And that, I mean, that kind of hit me. That, I don't know, that really kind of broke my heart a little bit for him, because even though you know that this is the Twilight Zone and it, not everything is going to be as it seems, like, in that moment, like, seeing that grave marking and seeing the name of one of his crew members, and getting confirmation from that grave marking that man has died, that man has died. It's like, and it's really impressive how brief this is too, because this is just all kind of coming at once. But Embry seeing that, that's the end of his hope. Like, that's confirmation that he's dead and that the rest of his crew are likely dead too. And just the thought that knowing that he had a responsibility to protect these men and to guide these men and to be in charge of these men, and the thought of him waking up after they had already crashed and attempted to survive and then failed to survive, like, the idea of someone who feels like they're responsible for the survival of a whole group of people missing out on the surviving and failed survival of those people, it has this really profound, heartbreaking pain to it. Like, he is, in that moment, he is super alone, and he knows that he couldn't protect his crew and that he failed them. And it's like such a profound and really heartbreaking moment for the episode and for that character. And I thought that was just really, really incredible. And again, the brevity of it, just like, he just sees that and all of that comes into focus for the audience, or for me at least. It just, like, all of that kind of hit like a ton of bricks, because we've had at that point, I don't remember at what time that was in the episode, but probably 10, 15 minutes of him searching for his crew and wondering what's going on. You get all of this, you get so much information about his relationship and his relationship with the crew and his dynamic within the crew, that seeing that grave marking in seeing his reaction to it, just knows, like, you just know, like, what that means for that character and for that dynamic in that group. It's just really, really incredible and heartbreaking. And then immediately after that, we get a shot of the Jets, which I wrote in my notes, Jets, whoa, surprise time travel. Because I mean, I'm such a huge fan of time travel, but this was a fun little misdirection there, because it's not necessarily time travel, or it's not time travel, it's all in his mind. But I just love that. Again, I love that kind of wink it to the audience, because we get that. We see the Jets and everything, and then we wonder, like, okay, those are clearly not World War II aircraft. There's something seriously weird going on. Did he time travel? Like in The Last Flight. But then immediately after that, Embry's saying, like, Jets, I shouldn't know what Jets are. This is 1943. I don't understand what's going on. So it's like an even more, an even deeper mystery is at foot there, because he's aware. Not only is he aware that, or not only are we aware that it's outside of the time of the episode that those planes should have appeared, the character knows it, that they're unfamiliar, but also knows that they are modern aircraft. He also knows that he shouldn't know what that is. So that brings about so many more questions than just simply having him looking at them and say, what are those? Or having him, be confused by it otherwise. It's really interesting way to play with the audience. And then we get another really heartbreaking moment where he's talking to his crew. He's running around. He goes back to the cockpit and asks Blake if he's ever heard of Jets. And then he gets this moment where he's yelling and telling them that he's going to get the plane flying, and he's going to get them back to safety, and he's going to rescue everyone. And it's just really sad, because you know that this is his sanity is breaking, and that he's really clinging to this thought that he can rescue them and he can protect them, even though it's very obvious at this point that he can't, and that they're nowhere to be found, and that he's likely lost them for good. And then that kind of comes to a head or culmination of the episode, is that he starts laughing at the King Nine, and he's laughing hysterically, and he's still trying to rationalize it as a hallucination, and he's trying to just summon the crew at this point. And at that moment, I kind of thought, for a brief moment, I thought the absolute scariest thing that this episode can do, and the scariest thing that can happen in this episode, is that it could have ended with it revealing that he really is alone in the desert, and that there isn't some Twilight Zone twist. He's just there, and he's freaking out and everything, and leaving a ton of questions. Of course, had that been the case, it probably would have been more disappointing than anything, but it would be more, it would have been unsettling if it just ended with the realization that, yeah, he is alone, and there's nothing he can do, and he's completely helpless. And we get another creepy, shot with his mirage of the crew. He's summoning the crew essentially in front of him, and then when they appear, they're laughing and they're happy, and it's really creepy and unsettling, especially since we've seen the grave marking for Klein, so we got confirmation that he's dead. It's just really creepy to see them in a group laughing, and a lot like the shot of Blake in the cockpit, like, he's like, this is a very brief thing. We only get like a few seconds of it, but it's enough to really leave an impression on you. It kind of reminds me just very vaguely, and mostly just because it's really brief, it reminds me a little bit of the movie Sunshine by Danny Boyle. There's a scene where they're going into a derelict spaceship, and in front of the, like, Danny Boyle cut in frames, only a couple frames at a time, just images of the crew of the ship that they're investigating. And it's just like very brief, like, shots of the crew from a picture that's shown earlier in the movie. It's a really great movie, and that's a really unsettling kind of effect there. So seeing the brief glimpses of the crew, throughout King Nine, or at least in those two spots in King Nine, kind of reminded me a little bit of what Danny Boyle eventually did in Sunshine, both to really good effect because both were really unsettling. And then his final like plea to God to let me in to he says, please let me in on it. Let me know what's going on. Let me in on it. And he repeats it a few times. Like that's really unnerving. And it's pretty heartbreaking because we're kind of following this guy as he's trying to make sense of what's going on while we're also trying to make sense of what's going on, but we can't and he can't. So like we both feel like we failed and him just kind of pleading to be let in on what's going on and just for to know what's going on is really unsettling and really heartbreaking. And then we get the reveal that he's in a hospital in the present day in 1960 and that he had seen a newspaper headline saying World War II bomber found intact in desert, and that that caused him to pass out or faint, and then the ambulance came and got him and took him to the hospital. And it's revealed we get the backstory that it was his plane and his crew, but Embry didn't go on the mission and it got lost. So he's been carrying the weight of not being there with his crew for 17 years, and it's a lot to it's caused his mind to essentially snap. And one funny thing, and this is, I don't know, I just thought this was kind of silly of me to really think, but I noticed that when he woke up or when we see the hospital, they have the newspaper just at the foot of his bed. So I think it's kind of funny that like obviously it's, you know, the psychiatrist and the doctor probably walked in with the newspaper and set it down. But I just thought it was funny, just the thought that they, like, this guy is in the hospital because he is... because he's suffering a mental breakdown because he saw a newspaper headline and they're just going to leave the newspaper right in bed with him. but yeah, I thought that was just kind of a funny thing that I thought. But that we get that as that's the answer to why he knew about jets. And that's kind of, it all comes together in that moment that we know that, which it's kind of, it's interesting because it's both part of what he was guessing was going on, and it's kind of something that the audience can kind of not figure out, but think like, okay, well, that's very likely what's going to happen is that he's going to wake up and be imagining all of that. But it's not a detriment to the episode at all because it is more about his guilt and his relationship with the crew and how. What it meant for him to not be on the bomber with them or not be with them in their final moments. Like that's what the episode's more about than what is actually going on, and it's more profound that way. And then we get the ending where with the sand and the shoe. I thought that was a nice touch and very Twilight Zone-esque to just have them end on a note that's completely ambiguous and shows that it's not just a mental thing. It's not just him having a mental breakdown. It's the Twilight Zone taking that mental breakdown, transporting him to something and escalating it to a point and then bringing him back to reality. And that sand in the shoe is kind of our indication that yes, it's the powers of the Twilight Zone that's transporting him to this thing and that's kind of orchestrating everything. I think that'll do it for my review of King 9 Will Not Return. As far as trivia goes, I do have just a few things. Of course, this is the first Twilight Zone episode to feature the iconic theme music. And also the first to feature an on-camera Rod Serling narration at the beginning of the episode. I'm super excited for the rest of the season, the rest of the show, really, for those reasons. And also, previous Twilight Zone director Robert Parrish was originally supposed to direct this episode, but for unknown reasons, he was replaced by Buzz Kulik. And also another fun bit of trivia is that this episode in the end was about $15,000 over budget. I think that was due to the costs of transporting the bomber to and from the set and everything. It kind of amplified production costs there. So overall, I think that King 9 will not return. I think that it's a really solid, really strong first episode for season 2. I kind of wonder if it was by design that they had an episode that was similar in subject to Where Is Everybody. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it's an interesting comparison to make, because both are about military men that are alone in a setting and dealing with Twilight Zone things there. I kind of wonder if that was something that's by design, since it's the first episode of both seasons. But either way, I think that the finished product was different enough and unique enough and stood out in its own right and carved its own story out of it, that it wasn't derivative of anything or anything like that. It wasn't derivative of any other episodes. It just had some comparisons to be made. And the story and the writing and the performing, we're all just top-notch, really well done, and really beautiful. Really beautiful and heartbreaking episode of The Twilight Zone. And before we move on to this week's bonus review, here's a highlight from episode 183 of The Obsessive Viewer, which is a podcast that I host with my friends Mike and Tiny over at obsessiveviewer.com. And yeah, go ahead and here's the clip.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, $4 for everything Monty Python is great for me.
Oh, like, yeah.
That's perfect. Of course, you can find The Obsessive Viewer on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and at obsessiveviewer.com. And you can find the episode you just heard a clip from at obsessiveviewer.com/OV183. Okay, and my bonus review for this episode is Bomber's Moon, which is episode 36 from season 2 of Playhouse 90. The entire episode is available on YouTube. The video quality isn't that great, but again, it's a 1958 Playhouse 90 episode. So, you know, it's pretty solid for how old it is. This episode aired on May 22nd, 1958. It starred Bob Cummings, Rip Torn, Martin Balsam, Hazel Court, and, the sponsors were Your Gas Company, Allstate Insurance, and Camel Cigarettes. Which, during the ad break for Camel, James Daly was the kind of spokesperson for it, who played Gart Williams in A Stop at Willoughby. And also Cliff Robertson introduced it. It was like the host of it. I don't know if that was like his regular gig for Playhouse 90 or what, but that was pretty interesting. So let's see. So Bomber's Moon aired May 22nd, 1958. And I will read the plot description real quick. I'm not going to spoil it, of course. I like to keep the bonus reviews to be spoiler free. So I'll just give my overall thoughts on it, and then you can check it out on YouTube. So Bomber's Moon is about a hard-hearted colonel loses many men in his group's bombing missions over World War II Japan or World War II Germany, but keeps on going and won't tolerate lightly a young major losing his nerve under the strain, who refuses to continue. And that's actually incorrect, because it's actually a lieutenant that loses his nerve, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, and this episode was directed by John Frankenheimer. So it opens with this really beautiful Twilight Zone-esque opening, like, not monologue, but like opening narration. That's just a crawl that you would read on it, and it's really beautifully written. It talks about how this story is set in England in 1943, but it's about war, and it can be about any time and any war and any man. And I thought that it was just really beautifully written. So it opens with the Bomber's Moon, which is a bar in England that's actually called the Crescent Moon, but they had crossed out Crescent and wrote Bombers on the sign. So it's kind of this bar that it seems like the American fighter pilots and the American army people go to when they have leave. And there's a lot of dialogue at the loaded up at the front that has a lot of really great characterization for all the characters. Martin Balsam is a major who's friends with Bob Cummings is a colonel character who is Colonel Culver. He's the kind of stiff, like very hard man who's very stern and doesn't let the emotion of war impact him as much as it does other men. And there's a camaraderie between them and among the whole group. Everyone's having a good time. It's very kind of antithetical to what war is. And there's a barkeep there who is kind of the guy who he's seen so many men come into the bar. They have a rapport with everyone. He has a conversation with Culver, asking him how the most recent bombing run went. And it's really great how that kind of bond forms or is introduced in the episode. He mentions kind of offhand that there isn't a lot of the old group left, and it's implied that because when they go out on a mission, you know, not everyone comes back. So they've been going to that bar frequently enough that the barkeep has noticed that that they're losing a lot of men. And he talks about how Culver tells him about how a Lieutenant Olson didn't make it. And the barkeep just says, "Oh, that's too bad. Today was his birthday." And it's like a nice, like kind of piece of writing there to showcase something. It comes into play later, but then there's a reveal that a Lieutenant Harrison was supposed to be on the mission, but he had aborted the mission before they had made it to their destination. So he flew the plane back, and that caused a lot of conflict or a lot of raised eyebrows from Culver, because this was like his fourth in a month that he's aborted. And that's kind of the introduction to kind of the central drama. Is Culver has this confrontation with Harrison. Like they bump heads a lot throughout the story. And each time it's freaking electric, really. it's really fascinating, because throughout the story, Culver is this really strong-willed person who keeps up a very strong front to everyone, and he's not one to take the loss of friends heavily, because he wants to focus on the missions and everything. He has a line to the barkeep where he says, "I don't have time to deal in bereavement," which is kind of his thesis statement for that character throughout the story. And what I love about that is that the barkeep actually responds to him and says that he sounds a lot like a stormtrooper, like he's comparing him to a Nazi stormtrooper. And he kind of brushes that comparison aside. But it's really interesting, because the conflict between Culver and Harrison, because Harrison is kind of the opposite of Culver. He is the guy who's aborted four missions, because he was afraid or he wasn't able to do it. And it shows, like, there's a conversation between Harrison and Culver where Culver asks him, like, why are you doing this? Why are you letting us down? Why aren't you going on the missions? And Harrison says that he just can't function. He freezes up. He forgets what he's doing. He forgets the mission. He forgets everything. It really talks about the pressure that the pilots are under. And Rip Torn in that moment, like, his performance is amazing. It's really a really strong scene overall. And But what I love about the kind of relationship between Culver and Harrison is that Culver is, as I said, he's this very strong-willed person who doesn't let things get to him. Harrison lets a lot get to him. He's crushing under the pressure, or he's cracking under the pressure. And what I love is that Culver has this grudge against Harrison. He has this animosity toward this lieutenant because he sees him as a coward. But what it's really about is that Culver sees Harrison as a reflection of what Culver himself is feeling on the inside. And so everything that he's putting out to everyone, like he's everything that he's saying, and the strong front that he's doing, that's just what it is. It's a front. He's actually having these doubts and these worries and everything, and he's internalizing them. So when he sees someone who's feeling the same things, letting it affect their work and their ability to do things or to continue fighting, it just makes him just see the anger at him and just really, really carry this level of disdain toward the lieutenant. And then that's Culver and Harrison. On the other side of things, we have Culver and Martin Balsam's character, who he's kind of the comic relief and kind of the good, like kind of comic relief of the episode, really. He is, and Martin Balsam, I love the guy. He's fantastic. There's a great moment earlier in the episode where he is chatting up a barmaid, and he's talking to her about sports, and he Culver comes up to him and says, "Hey, do you think it's about time we need to leave?" And then he's like, "No, she's never heard of basketball. I need to tell her about basketball." And then Culver comes back to him and says, like, "Hey, do you think we should leave now?" And then he's like, "No, I've got like 40 other sports that she's never heard of that I'm working on telling her." It's really fun. Like, he's a very suave character. He's very kind of he's not as tightly wound as Culver. And he's also compassionate toward Harrison. So it's this interesting thing where he and Culver, their friendship, it reminds me of the friendship in the Purple Testament between the two main officers in that episode. I can't remember their names off the top of my head. But it's like this camaraderie, like this bond of like brotherhood of fighting. Fighting in the war together. It's really strong, strongly developed there. And I won't go into any more detail because there is some really great narrative things that happen throughout it. But there is one kind of extended like air combat sequence that made me really wonder how they accomplished it. I know that it was parts of it were pre-filmed, obviously, so it wasn't like a live production or anything, but I mean they would have had to have used archival footage from World War II, because it was just incredibly authentic. It's like it's like dogfighting, really, and bombing runs, and it's this really pretty impressive sequence where they're showing these, and it's the integration of the what I assume is archival footage from World War II. The integration of that footage to and from scenes in the aircrafts with the actors talking. It's really seamless the way that they were able to do that. I'm sure that they just did like a projection against a wall for the interior shots, but just, it didn't come across as hokey at all or anything. It looked very authentic and real. And I really appreciated that. And there's some really, really amazing dramatic beats throughout it. I highly recommend checking out this story in this episode. There's one kind of monologue by Culver later in the episode, where he's berating Harrison for something. To give more context, because there's a few scenes like that, without spoiling it, it's the quote unquote unrestricted data monologue where he says that it's what they're arguing about or what he's berating him about is unrestricted data. And so that's why he's okay with saying it out loud in front of everyone. But that monologue is so brutal and amazing. It's really astonishing to me how consistently Serling's work is coupled with such strong actors. Like, it's freaking beautiful you can see the way that a really strong, beautifully written piece is given to someone who has complete command over that character and the performance that they're giving. And it's this beautiful, like, symmetry between them, or this beautiful confluence of talent that just to see such a talented actor like Bob Cummings performing the work of Serling in that moment is just really, really fascinating and really amazing to watch. Yeah, I think that's about it, because I don't want to spoil anything else. But I think that the ending is really satisfying to me. There's a really amazing scene where Bob Cummings is sitting there and kind of taking in a lot of things, and it's really powerful the way that the episode ends. I really appreciated that. And I mean, that's my review of Bomber's Moon. Again, it is available in its entirety on YouTube. I'll put a link in the show notes of this episode, and it'll also be on the episode webpage at anthologypod.com/034. So that's it for season one or season two of episode one. Wow. That's it for episode one of season two of Anthology and of The Twilight Zone. As you can tell from this episode, I'm a little bit out of practice with the whole one man podcast thing, but yeah, I'm getting back into it, and it's going to be a blast. On that similar note, if you're listening to this and you were at my panel at Indiana Comic Con on April 15th, I hosted a panel at Indiana Comic Con about hosting a solo podcast. I had such a great time. And if you're listening to this because of that panel, or if you were at that panel, I really appreciate you coming and everything. I had a really great interactive audience. They were really fantastic. And it was a really great time. It was the first time I've ever done anything like that. And it was like I hosting my own panel and being there by myself to host it. It was really exhilarating and really really awesome. I think at this time, well, it doesn't matter, because at this time I will have made the decision. But I did Facebook Live the entire panel on the Facebook page for Anthology, and I think I am going to probably post the audio here. So it'll be. A separate episode, likely dropping before this episode. So all that was kind of pointless to say. Anyway, to close things out, if you like what you've heard and you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is by leaving a rating and a quick review on iTunes. Just a couple sentences. It doesn't even need to be a sentence. Just rate it if you want to. That's the best way to kind of get Anthology out there to more people. And if you're feeling very generous, you can also donate to the podcast through PayPal by clicking on the donate button on anthologypod.com. And also, in the interim between seasons, I added some reward tiers to Obsessive Viewers Patreon site. So you can also become a patron to Anthology at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. I have some specific reward tiers for Anthology listeners. The way Patreon works is that you just pledge however much money is for that reward tier, and it'll automatically take that money out each month. If you want to make a one-time donation that way, you can do that, but then just cancel it after it clears. I won't mind either way. I just appreciate you guys listening and everything in general. So once again, thank you guys so much for listening. Next week on the podcast, I'm going to be reviewing The Man in the Bottle, which is episode two of season two of The Twilight Zone. And my bonus review for that episode is going to be, and I have no idea if I'm going to pronounce this right, but I'm going to do it my best, Jay Suhate, which is an episode of The X-Files from season 7. episode 21 of The X-Files. That's on Netflix. And also, I'm going to be doing, and I'm currently in the process of doing, really, at this point, if you're now that you're listening to this, but here, probably in a couple days or within the week, I'm going to release my first episode reviewing Dimension 404, which is Hulu's new sci-fi anthology series from the guys at Rocket Jump. I'll be reviewing Matchmaker, and then I'll have more reviews coming out in the coming weeks for that, more bonus reviews coming out in the coming weeks. So having said all that, guys, that does it for episode 34 of Anthology. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thank you guys so much for your patience with me getting season 2 back up and running. And on that note, thank you guys for listening, and I'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. For more of Anthology and a full archive of my episodes, go to AnthologyPod.com. And if you want to help support the show, the easiest way you can do that is by leaving a rating and a review on iTunes. You can also make donations to the show courtesy of the donate link in the show notes of each episode and on AnthologyPod.com. For recurring donations, you can become a patron at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and just choose one of the Anthology reward tiers. If you enjoy Anthology, feel free to check out The Obsessive Viewer, a weekly movie and TV podcast I host with my friend Tiny and occasional guest co-hosts over at ObsessiveViewer.com. You can also join The Obsessive Viewer Facebook group at facebook.com/TheObsessiveViewer. For book reviews and commentary on the world of reading, check out our sister site at ObsessiveBookNerd.com. And for philosophical discussions from a secular viewpoint, check out my friends Chad and Amanda at TheSecularPerspective.com. Finally, if you'd like to contact me with your thoughts on the show, my reviews, my bonus reviews, or for any other reason, you can tweet me at ObsessiveViewer, send me an email at Matt@ObsessiveViewer.com, or send me a message on Facebook and like the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod. Once again, thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.